shapes on the ramp. One humanoid and one animal, whose form wasn't clearly defined. He counted to three and came out, blaster and flamethrower aimed. Myrta, minus helmet, was in the tight headlock of a Mandalorian in gray armor, and a large, gold-furred animal had its huge jaws locked around her leg, trailing a curtain of drool. It wasn't attacking, it was frozen, pinning her down, and stinking. And she didn't look scared, just embarrassed. Fett stared down the barrel of a custom Verpine rifle aimed one-handed.
"Well, well,"
said the Mandalorian in gray armor. He really did have a very fine pair of gray leather gloves.
"It's little Bobica. Last time we met, my brother was shoving your head down the freshers to teach you some manners. What do you want me for, Nervod?"
Galactic Alliance Guard Briefing Room, GAG Headquarters, Coruscant.
Ben was glad to be back among people he trusted. The sea of black uniforms might have been a sinister sight to some people, but to him, they felt like a brotherhood, like family. He was in that rare position of being young enough to be treated like one of the troopers, despite his officer status, and he liked that. The sense of camaraderie, and the knowledge that everyone watched everyone else's back was both comforting and thrilling. He settled into a seat on the end of a row in the briefing room. A trooper called Almok nudged him. Captain Lon Shivu strode onto the dais at the front of the room, looking as committed as ever. But Ben felt the reluctance and misgivings in him. He could sense it in a few of the other troopers, too, generally the ones who'd been in the CSF. Jason followed Shivu and got instant, undivided attention. "Brief for the next 48 hours, ladies and gentlemen," said Jason. "We're moving into a different phase. The priority now is to look for professionals, Confederation intelligence agents. Now, normally, we'd leave that to our colleagues in Alliance Intel. But seeing as we've got all their best operatives..." Applause and laughter interrupted him. He paused with a big grin and picked up again. "Seeing as we got the pick of the litter, we'll be helping them out. We'll also be providing close protection for Chief Omos and key ministers to relieve CSF, and monitoring for them. Results of interrogation suggest we might be looking at more targeted and professional assassination attempts, as in government agents, not just disgruntled amateurs and bounty hunters." A hand was raised at the front. Ben couldn't see who it was.
"What's monitoring in this context, sir?"
Jason flashed a hollow image onto the screen behind him. It showed a diagram of the various routes by which GA ministers could be reached, physically or virtually. Offices, home addresses, private clubs, routes to the Senate, comlinks.
"Like this," he said.
"Are we allowed to tap Senators' comlinks, sir?" asked Shivu.
"Under the Emergency Measures Act, we're authorized to carry out any surveillance to prevent acts of violence against ministers of state and visiting allies."
Shivu's face was unreadable, but Ben felt a sharp unhappiness in him. Now there was a guy who knew how to conceal what he was thinking. Tapping senators' comlinks didn't seem to bother anyone else at the briefing. Ben couldn't see the problem either. It made sense, for their own protection. The briefing broke up. Ben hung back to talk to Jason, getting a few joking comments about his recent absence as the troopers filed out, and giving as good as he got. He felt a sudden pressure at the back of his head, and when he looked around, Jason was watching him from the side of the dais, smiling slightly.
"They like you," he said. "That's good for an officer, as long as you're liked for the right reasons."
"Isn't it important to be respected instead?"
"What's respect, Ben?"
Ben pondered the question, hearing a subtle test in it.
"Thinking that a person does something right and that they do it better than you, and so you feel positive toward them."
"Excellent."
"That's not the same as being liked, though, is it?"
"Not at all. We can respect those we dislike," Jason said. "The way to be liked by your men is this, that they believe that you would never spend their lives cheaply, that their welfare comes first, and that you wouldn't ask them to do anything that you wouldn't do yourself, to share their trials and triumphs without being one of them. And they know that's how it has to be. because they know an officer has to make decisions that cost lives. And that's something you can only do if you remain sufficiently separate. Ben hadn't lost a trooper from 967th Commando yet. In fact, they had no fatalities or even serious injuries. They led charmed lives as far as the rest of the military were concerned. He had no idea how he'd feel if he had to put them in a position where deaths were inevitable. Jason seemed to read his mind again. Until you can make those decisions, you're not safe to lead.
But it's easier if you're prepared to die yourself, right? Because if you're willing to make the same sacrifice, that's the one thing that matters.
Jason leaned close to him. It inspires. It's the ultimate act of honesty with your troops.
I don't know which way I'll jump when the time comes, Ben said. Nobody does. But I'll try to do what's right for the majority.
Jason's smile was utterly luminous for a moment, but then it faded as if he'd recalled something awful. His force presence vanished for a few seconds and then returned.
That was weird, Ben thought.
Jason was standing right next to him, so what was he hiding from?
Can you teach me to do that?
Ben asked.
Hide in the force?
Jason seemed shaken. Why?
Because Lumaya is trying to kill me. I thought it might come in handy. Mom says she's got evidence that Lumaya thinks I killed her daughter. I don't remember a thing about what happened on that asteroid, Jason, but maybe it doesn't matter, because Lumaya believes it, and I bet she was behind what happened on Xyost.
Jason's face was carefully blank. Ben couldn't tell what he was thinking now, not even from the Force. Yes, why not? Jason said. His voice was softer, almost hesitant. Don't you worry about Lumaya. She's not up to killing you.
When can we start?
It's very simple.
Yeah,
Ben said dubiously. No, it is. The principle is simple. It's the practice that's hard. It might take you years to master it. Jason motioned him to sit down on the floor. Come on, meditation position. Ben sat down cross-legged and closed his eyes automatically, taking deeper and slower breaths, until he reached the stage where the world beyond him seemed distant and he was hyper-aware of his own body, even the movement of blood in his veins. Jason's voice seemed to be coming from another time and place. You're contained. The world can't touch you.
Yes.
Now, break the shell. Break the container. Jason's tone was even and soothing. See the world in its component atoms. See yourself as atoms, too. Find the line where you end and the world begins. Ben visualized the room around him and the air in it. It became a frozen snowfall of varying density. Some particles clustered, some scattered. Then he looked into himself and saw the microscopic unevenness of the surface of his skin, and the overlapping plates of keratin in his hair, and then beyond that to where he was just like the room around him, a snowstorm of molecules. Some of the room was within him as oxygen and dust, and some of him was in the room as fragments of skin and droplets of water. There was no line. There was no edge that divided Ben Skywalker from the room, or from Coruscant, or from the galaxy. He merged with it all. And it merged with him. There was nothing solid, just a warm, drifting sea of molecules, some of which assembled loosely and long enough to be Ben Skywalker. So you can do it. Jason's voice drifted from a long way away. Ben suddenly felt as if he were dissolving and would never be whole again. Panic gripped him. He jerked his eyes open with a massive effort, like tearing open rock with his bare hands. An effort so immense that he found himself gasping for air.
Oh, wow.
Now, Jason said softly, you need to practice regularly. Ben nodded, worried about looking too enthusiastic.
I will, he said. Any orders for me, or am I just going to be listening to comlinks now?
Oh, I have a mission for you. Jason reached into his jacket and pulled out a data pad. Read this. It's the original sources of the intelligence I received, so you can judge for yourself. Ben took the datapad and studied the screen. There were transcripts of comlink conversations, and even grainy images of a meeting taken from such an odd angle that it must have been captured by a spy droid in a very awkward location, probably on top of a cupboard. Men in expensive suits and tunics, sipping caff and talking in hushed tones. A man with well-cut dark hair, younger than Jason. Ben recognized him as Dur Gedgen.
"That's the Corellian Prime Minister," he said.
"That's all the intel gathered from our contacts inside the Corellian government offices. Read on. There was discussion of driving a wedge between Hapes and the Galactic Alliance. It sounded like the usual political maneuvering that always bored Ben until he started to read reoccurring phrases, like Queen Mother, and seeing the disadvantages of siding with the Alliance. And then there were references to removing obstacles. It all fell into place when he flicked to the next holoimage and saw a discussion of appropriate bounty hunters and who might be willing to operate in the Hapen Royal House. Ben might have been bored by politics, but he understood better than he imagined, and he knew he had to if he wanted to survive.
This is about Tenel Ka.
Correct.
Gedgen really did plan the attack on her then.
Correct. We finally have hard evidence, and so we can act.
What do you want me to do?
Ben asked, pretty sure what the answer would be. Assassinate Gedgen. Jason rubbed his forehead wearily. He's a piece of work, and he'll destabilize our allies. There's no negotiating with a man who routinely resorts to state-sponsored assassination like that. The Corellians need to know we can reach out and take them, too. Sober them up a bit. Way too cocky.
Isn't that what we're doing, though? How is our assassination different from theirs? Won't it just lead to more killings?
You want to do this by the book? Okay. Call Corellian Security and report Gedgen for conspiracy to murder. Oh, and for having Thrakken Sal Solo assassinated too. Even if we can't call my father in court to testify to that. Let's see how fast they arrest him.
I know.
You don't have to do it. Jason had that slightly wounded tone that said quite the opposite. But you proved you were competent at covert ops when we hit Centerpoint. And you can get a lot closer to Gedgen. A lot more easily than some big hairy commando like DeVille. You can look like a harmless teenager. Jason stared at him, head slightly on one side, with that almost smile that said he was sure Ben was going to say yes. I'll send you with good backup, Jason said. Shivu and Lakoff. Our contacts on Corellia are working out a time and place. You'll have to be ready to go at a moment's notice.
Galactic Alliance XJ-7 in neutral space between Corellia and Coruscant.
Mara wondered if she'd bother to spin Jason a line about why she needed to take an XJ-7. Look, Jason, it's like this. You've turned into a thug since Lumaya came on the scene, and the witch is trying to kill my son. So how's about I do what I do best and kill her for all our sakes? She would have loved to tell him that. But she still didn't know who Lumaya's accomplices were inside the GAG, and Jason didn't take kindly to doubts about his precious secret police. Mara tried Leia's comlink again, hopping from frequency to frequency in case she was being tracked. Old habits died hard, and she didn't want Crazy Woman 2, Alima, to get a fix on her, or Leia.
"We can't go on meeting like this,"
said Leia's voice. She laughed. And that was pretty remarkable under the circumstances. She didn't have much to laugh about.
"Do I have to give you a password?" "I'll trust you."
Mara checked her cockpit display, watching the frequency shift on the monitor in multicolored bars of light.
"You okay?"
"For a woman on the run, I'm doing great."
"I don't know where to start."
Hey, did your son really abandon you to suck vacuum? Because that'd be my first question."
"I'm so sorry, Leia. I really am. But I'm going to put a stop to this. Take Lumaya out of the equation. And I think you'll see a major improvement in Jason's attitude."
"Is that where you are now?"
"I'm trying to work out how Lumaya moves around. Forget all this light whip garbage. I'm going to find her ship and finish what Luke started. They're always vulnerable in transit.
Leia's end of the link went quiet for a few moments.
Want me to play bait?
Don't you think you've been through enough lately?
I can guarantee that Alima would show up if I asked nicely. And maybe Lumaya wouldn't be far behind.
Tell you what, why don't I lob in Ben and make certain of it?
Mara.
Sorry, I don't want to expose you to any more risk. But if I can devise a safer way of exploiting the fact that neither of those crazies can keep away from us, I'll do it.
We're going to need to break this link soon.
Okay, look, I have to see Jason sooner or later. Do you want me to put it to him straight? Ask him why he ran when you'd come to save him?
What if he tells you? And it's a reason I won't enjoy hearing.
Your call. But I want to know anyway, seeing as Luke and I were there to help him too, and wasted our time.
All I can say is do whatever you feel you must to get Lumaya. Then we'll see about bringing Jason back into the fold.
If I find Alima, I'll save her for you.
I'd like that.
Thought you might.
You take care, Mara.
Leia's link went dead. Mara had to assume she and Han were on Corellia, and that meant Alima couldn't get at her so easily. Mara turned the XJ-7 and checked Ben's transponder again. Still on Coruscant. That didn't guarantee his safety, but at least she could pinpoint him. She zoomed her screen in on the trace, and the coordinates resolved into a grid, and then into neighborhoods and skylanes. Ben was at GAGHQ. She could locate him accurately to within 3 meters. He liked the vibroblade she'd given him. She felt bad not telling him it housed a long-range passive transponder, and that it had saved her more than once because she'd used it as a homing beacon. But that was just detail. It was a superb weapon, so it wasn't a lie. The tagged vibroblade ensured she knew exactly where Ben was at all times now. She had one more transponder left, and she was saving that for a rainy day. She turned her attention back to Lumaya. The last time she'd been on the resort satellite, Ben wasn't even around, but Jason was. Who was Lumaya going after, Ben or Jason? If Lumaya's presence was making Jason forget what being a Jedi was all about, then maybe Mara needed to keep tabs on Jason, too. That was easier said than done. Then, something vanished from the Force. Ben! It was like a shape flashing past her peripheral vision, and a familiar background noise stopping abruptly, leaving a dead, soundless ringing in the ears. Ben's gone. Ben had disappeared from the Force. Mara's hand was on the controls to jump to hyperspace and head back to Coruscant at top speed when the sense of her son flooded back, as if the sound had been turned on again. Her stomach rolled. Maybe it's me. He'd done it before as a little boy, scared by the last war, the one against the Yuuzhan Vong. It was uncontrolled and instinctive, but what Mara had just experienced felt like something more deliberate. When she concentrated on him, he felt fine. No, more than fine. He felt elated.
Southside Landing Strip, Kuat City.
So, said the clone.
He hauled Myrta to her feet and dusted her down, and she tolerated it.
What part of stay out of my way didn't you understand?
Myrta opened her mouth to give him a piece of her mind, but Fett cut in.
Nice of you to drop in, but can we continue this discussion elsewhere? Ah, the almighty Mandalore. Hanging a gang boss over a balcony in the center of town. Yeah, that's subtle.
The clone motioned the animal into the cargo bay, where it lay rumbling ominously like a distant storm.
I was looking for you.
Fett closed the hatch.
We have to go. Shut up and secure yourself for takeoff. You abducting me? Would you rather have a chat and a cup of calf while we wait for the Kuat police and all the Frag scumbags to show up? Okay, I borrowed the speeder anyway, sort of. Tell you what, drop us off on Coruscant, we'll be on our way.
The clone grabbed his helmet with both hands and lifted it off. He didn't look any less intimidating, but after a couple of seconds he broke into an unexpected grin that completely transformed him. He looked more like Fett's brother than his twin, not identical at all.
They say there's some family resemblance, but I don't see it myself.
Fett paused for a telling moment and then stalked off to the cockpit. Myrta wasn't certain whether to land a punch on the clone or thank him for showing up.
What's your name?
Jang Skirata. And you?
Myrta Gev.
Then she realized it didn't have the required impact.
Fett's granddaughter.
Jang raised his eyebrows and burst out laughing. The animal lifted its head and whined. Myrta went forward to the cockpit to strap herself in for takeoff, unhappy at the laughter still ringing behind her.
You let him ambush you,
said Fett. Myrta seethed.
I didn't pick him up on my sensors, and I didn't even see him coming at me. He flattened me before I could kalik him.
Stab.
You're learning.
And you're not.
Fett punched the controls, and Kuat dwindled to a disc beneath them.
He didn't check visually. Don't rely on the helmet tech all the time.
Hey, you didn't spot him either. That's gotta be stealth armor.
He's a null.
There was some history there. She could see that.
They were Black Ops clones. The Kaminoans attempt to improve on my dad's genome for cloning. You can see it didn't work.
She gripped the console in front of her as Fett tapped in the coordinates for Coruscant, 000, and Slave 1 jumped to hyperspace.
Course laid in. Let's go talk to him.
Jang was sitting cross-legged on the deck of the cargo bay, face to face with the animal, which was gazing into his eyes and making little whining, grumbling sounds, as if trying to get him to understand something. He seemed oblivious to its smell. They both looked around when Fett and Myrta came through the hatch.
What is he?
Myrta asked.
You asking me or Lord Myrdalan?
Jang held his gloved fingers up in front of the animal's face, some kind of signal that produced instant attention and made it lie flat on the deck. Jang got to his feet.
He's an it. Strills are hermaphrodites. I promised Myrd's last owner I'd look after it when he passed to the Manda. Strills live a lot longer than we do.
Fett shoved his thumbs into his belt in that I'm fed up with waiting pose.
When you two finish the nature lesson...
Jang had more lines, fewer gray hairs, and a heavier build than Fett.
So why do you want me? Need a loan? You've been looking for me for weeks, because I've been hearing all kinds of people putting out the word for me. I'm dying,
Fett said. Jang chewed over the news, head slightly to one side.
Sorry to hear that. You're not the only clone who met a premature end.
Fett usually cut to the chase. Now he stood silent for a while, jaw muscles twitching. Myrta wondered if he was hurt by the rebuff. She guessed that he was working up the hardest thing he'd ever had to say. He was.
I want your help, Jang.
Jang just stared at him. The staring went on for a long time. Myrta wondered who would give in first. Then it went on a little too long.
Oh, for fear feck's sake,
she sighed.
It's the cloning. His tissues are breaking down and he's got tumors. He needs to know what stopped you aging at double the rate, because his doctor can't help him and neither can the Kaminoans, not even Ton Wee.
Fett pursed his lips slightly.
What she said?
Jang looked Fett up and down.
You had trouble with your leg, I heard. Had to have a transplant, yes? You're very well informed. I'm still a Tepaka boy at heart. I stay in touch with events in the old country. What have I got to pay you to quit gloating and give me what I need? No offense, but you can shove your credits where your armor don't reach. Mandalore. You don't know what I need yet. I can guess. Kosai's research.
Fett gave Jang's gloves a pointed glance.
Because I know you found it. You certainly found her. There isn't any data,
Jang said. Fett didn't even blink.
You must have taken all your vitamins then, because you should be dead by now. I didn't say the research didn't exist. I'm saying that we destroyed it after we took what we needed.
Fett absorbed that slowly. Myrta's heart sank in that conflicting way it had now. Part of her desperate to find a reason to love her Babuir. and half of her wishing Leia Solo hadn't blocked her shot when she tried to kill him.
Do something to make me forgive you. Please, anything.
You could have made a fortune from it,
Fett said.
We didn't want it used again. Ever.
You can't stop cloning. You never will.
No, but we put a dent in the Kaminoans. That's better than nothing. I don't like Kaminoans.
I can tell.
Fett glanced at Jang's fine gray gloves.
But I've worked for worse.
They paid you? They bred us like animals.
Jane looked as if he'd remembered something satisfying.
So Tonwi's still alive. I always wondered.
Leave her alone, Jang. She's old now.
So am I. No thanks to her. So how long have you got to live?
A year, maybe two if my luck holds.
How long before you have to hand over command?
I don't know.
The last thing Mandalore needs at the moment is a power vacuum.
Myrta saw a glimmer of hope.
So help him, Jang.
Best I can do is a blood sample, he said. But I think you'll hand it over to the Kaminoans, Boba, or your doctors will. And we really wouldn't be very happy about that. Not at all.
We?
Myrta felt she was getting on better with Jang. She'd used her advantage as the harmless, tragic granddaughter.
How many of you are there left?
You don't need to know that. Look, I've got grandchildren too, Boba. And great-grandchildren. I've got a family on Mandalore. So I care what happens when you're gone. Much as it pains me, your Buard here is right. Mandalore needs you for the foreseeable future.
Fett made a very good job of looking bored.
So I get the blood if I keep the Kaminoans out of it?
Not that simple, said Jang.
It never is.
You give me blood and tissue samples and I'll get something made up for you, if I can.
And I'm supposed to trust you?
As much as I'm supposed to trust you. And don't even think about taking a sample from me the hard way.
Okay.
Fett's jaw twitched again.
Thank you.
He made it sound like a foreign language, awkward and unfamiliar in his mouth. Myrta resisted the urge to react.
Well done, Babu Ear. Was that so hard?
Jang wasn't done, though.
There's a condition, of course.
There always is.
Fett crossed his arms.
What?
Get your ships back to Mandalore. Listen to Kadika's advice and build a strong, united, stable state. Prove you're half the man that Jester Mareel and Fen Scheisse were. All you want to do is emulate your old man, Boba. But you're too scared to exceed him, aren't you? You can't be better than Jango. That would never do.
Myrta flinched. Mentioning his father without due reverence seemed to be the one thing that really got Fett riled. His voice didn't change, but he unfolded his arms with slow care.
My father finally destroyed the Death Watch. That's his legacy to Mandalore.
Sectarian feud. Irrelevant to most Mandoarde's lives. Now, are you gonna give me a sample?
What kind of scientist do you have access to that I haven't?
Some things, Jang said softly, can't be bought. I have my resources, believe me. Got a medpack with a sharp in it?
Yes.
Draw some blood, then.
I'll do it,
said Myrta. Myrta didn't expect him to flinch when she finally found a vein, and he didn't. The few moments while she applied pressure to the blood vessel with her thumb to stop the bleeding afterward were the longest of her life, because he wouldn't meet her eyes, and it reminded her that she could touch him and still not reach him. Jang held the vial of red-black blood up to the light and admired it.
That'll do nicely.
GAG Headquarters, Coruscant.
Captain Hilo Gurdon smiled and beckoned Ben into a dark office. Somehow, the two elements combined into Ben's least favorite way to spend an afternoon.
Behold,
he said, and Ben's eyes adjusted to the low light. There were no windows, The only illumination was from banks of hollow screens and monitors. Ben realized there were GAG troopers sitting at consoles, with that glaze of defocused concentration that looked like blank boredom.
The eyes and ears of the guard. Welcome to the monitoring center.
The ultimate in scrutiny. Gurdon steered Ben by his shoulder, taking him to an alcove away from the active consoles.
This is where we keep an eye on senators and other social misfits, for their own good.
Whose calls do you tap?
Ben felt uneasy about it.
I bet it's not even exciting.
All government staff are specialists of probable and proven scumbags and politicians, said Gurdon. And given the number of senators and the volume of hot air they emit, we get automated voice recognition systems to do it, or we'd be here for the next 1,000 years. If the droid picks up any keywords of interest, it tags the conversation and alerts us. Then we have to sit and actually listen to it.
One of the troopers, Zverk, was ladling sweetener into a cup of caff. He sipped it gingerly, looking slightly comical with an audio buffer lead dangling from his ear.
I joined the army to see the galaxy, he whispered. But all I got was 8-hour watches of listening to weird politicians making appointments to...
Ben's 14, Gurdon said.
Well, if you want him to do monitoring, he's gonna hear stuff that'll make his hair curl, sir.
Ben had never considered what tapping comlinks of suspects and people in sensitive posts actually entailed.
I won't faint, he said. And if I'm old enough to get shot at, I'm old enough to hear... stuff.
Can't argue with that logic.
Gurdon sat him down at a console and gave him an earpiece.
Okay. The screen here shows you the sound files the droids lined up as worth listening to, as well as holocam footage. You just work through it and make notes if anything seems worth following up. You're looking for anyone who might be contacting senators and seems a bit odd. Any conversations about senators or government staff? Look, you're a Jedi. You've probably got a sixth sense about this stuff, just like you have about hidden explosives.
Soda-neck battle dogs, said Zverk. But Lieutenant Skywalker smells better, and he can do tricks.
Ben settled in his seat to begin checking recordings. The monitoring center smelled strongly of caff. Ben felt in need of some too after a few hours, and he lost himself in a conversation between two government staff about the regular route that a certain senator took from the Senate to her apartment. But he was jerked out of his concentration by a rustle of fabric and quiet, intense activity at another console. Zverk had summoned Gurdon, and they both looked grim. Ben paused to listen.
You sure?
Gurdon asked.
Run a voice profile if you don't believe me, Zverk said. That's the Corellian PM.
There were 10 people in the room, and they'd all stopped to listen. Gedgen's soothingly persuasive voice, with its faint accent, was telling someone that there was no point doing this through the usual channels, because nobody else was in a negotiating mood.
You and I know that this could be solved by the removal of a few hotheads. Some of our military needs slapping down, and so do some of yours. I'd call an immediate ceasefire if I could be assured of a few things.
Such as?
Said the unmistakable voice of Chief of State Omos. They were tapping the Chief of State's secure comm line. Ben wasn't sure they had authorization to do that.
We'll agree that Corellia pools its military assets with the GA, as long as we have an opt-out clause that says we have the right to withdraw it if our own needs are more urgent. Niathal has to go. Jason Solo has to go. Once that's out of the way, we're back to normal, and you've got what you want.
Center point.
Well, we're having problems repairing it anyway.
Center point has to be made inoperative.
A pause. Too brief even for most people to notice, but Ben did.
It already is. But if you want a multiplanetary force or observers there, fine.
What about the Bothans and the other planets fighting their own wars?
I can bring the Kaminoans into line, and the Bothans, well, once we're all back in the GA, then Bothawee's got to toe the line. The little people, if the fighting gets out of hand, will commit troops to put a stop to that.
The Senate won't agree to this.
Take Niathal and Solo out of the equation first, and they'll calm down. What's left of the Senate, anyway?
Take out? They won't go quietly. They might split the Senate. Gasil's totally in their camp, and he's got weight.
Well, there's take out, and take out.
Omas swallowed, but didn't respond. Gedgen filled the silence.
You know we have a job to do before this draws in the whole galaxy.
Okay.
We need to meet. Can you get to Volptr?
Long pause.
I'll find an excuse. Send me the details.
Gurdon stood looking at the screen, as if he could get some sense out of it if he stared long enough. Zverk sat with his chin propped on his hand, gazing up at the captain for orders.
Get a transcription of that to Colonel Solo right away.
Supreme Commander's Office, Senate Building, Coruscant.
Jason read the transcript a third time and laid his datapad down on Niathal's desk. She had a hologram of Mon Cal on the wall behind her, all shimmering blue ocean and sinuous buildings emerging from the waves in floating cities. He wondered if she was homesick. Right now, she was fresh back from a battle that hadn't gone as planned, and impatient to see Cal Omas about it. Nothing like a united front in wartime. He leaned back in the chair, fingers meshed behind his head. So we're not the flavor of the month. Our glorious leader didn't exactly spring to our defense. Niathal's white uniform didn't look crumpled, even though she'd just disembarked from a warship fresh from a battle.
Smacks of ingratitude, I'd say.
She wasn't one for humor. You realize that when Gedgen says someone has to go, he doesn't mean a golden handshake and a framed certificate thanking them for loyal service.
Spit it out, Jason.
He was behind Sal Solo's premature death. She narrowed her eyes, heavy with sarcasm.
I'm shocked, I tell you, shocked.
And the attempt on the Hapen Queen Mother's life. We're next. Niathal's nostrils closed tight for a second. It was a giveaway with Mon Cal's. A little tell that said they were surprised, and not in a good way.
He wouldn't be stupid enough to try that.
Right now, I don't know what he'd try.
Omas isn't a fool. He must have a good idea of what he's dealing with.
What do you think he's up to?
All he wants to do is hold the Alliance together. He always thinks a few raps over the knuckles can bring naughty governments into line. Well, it didn't work with Corellia, and now he's watching the Alliance shrink a planet at a time.
Jason looked away for a moment, gathering himself. If I feel we have to act to restore stability and security, will you be standing with me? Will you stage a coup with me? Did I really say that? Niathal did pause, but it wasn't the taken-aback pause of someone shocked by an outrageous proposal. Just a moment of sizing up Jason Solo.
You might have the GAG behind you, Jason, but you need the fleet too, don't you? And the rest of the army.
Is that a yes?
It's an if things get worse. I put my allegiance to the GA before my allegiance to an individual.
I'm interested to see that the military will cross the line from carrying out the government's will into deciding policy.
In case you forget,
said Niathal softly,
the Office of Supreme Commander effectively combines the role of Defense Secretary and the Chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I am a politician. I also happen to be the most senior military officer.
It's time we had a chat with Omas, then. Jason stood up and brushed down his black GAG fatigues with his hands. Just to be certain. For all we know, he might be meeting Gedgen to whip out a blaster himself and effect another Corellian regime change. Niathal followed him into the corridor that led to the Chief of State's suite. Elegant blue and gold marble and niche-studded walls with fine statues from across the galaxy. The doors to the Chief of State's suite slid open, and he walked into the quiet, thickly carpeted reception room with Niathal at his side. Not behind, not ahead, but exactly level with him. Omos was leaning over his aide's desk, talking in hushed tones.
"I'm sorry to have kept you waiting," he said, looking up. "Do come in."
Jason moved his chair so he wasn't forced to squint at Omos against the light from the window. So did Niathal. It was an eloquent, silent statement of who would have the upper hand, and they hadn't rehearsed it. Omos, a man finely attuned to the subtleties of body language and psychological advantage, radiated wariness in the Force. He knew he was dealing with a united front.
"Who's first?"
Niathal inclined her head politely.
"I'll keep it brief," she said.
"We can't get involved in every little skirmish to keep obscure senators and tinpot heads of state in the Alliance. We're at overstretch. We couldn't maintain the Corellian blockade, and now we have the Bothans ramping up. Pick your battles, Chief of State. I can't fight them all."
Omos did his displacement act and poured himself a cup of caff from the jug on his desk. There was just one cup, and he didn't offer more.
"If we fail to show support to Alliance member worlds, then we lose them," he said. "This is basic numbers. We've been through all of this. If more secede, then we've lost. The issue of how we maintain a joint defense force for the Alliance, which is what started this, in case we forget, then becomes academic."
"If we don't concentrate our forces on the worlds that present the most immediate and serious threat, then we'll be ground down a ship at a time, and we might not even be able to defend Coruscant if it comes to the worst."
"You think it might come to that? Is this about Coruscant in the end?"
"Of course it is,"
Niathal said.
"It always is. The Alliance and Coruscant are indivisible, and that's half the problem for all the other worlds."
Omos turned to Jason.
"Your turn, Colonel."
"I share the Admiral's fears about overstretch. Corellia is still the heart of this. I say we devote all our resources in the immediate term to an all-out assault on Corellia. Invasion, in fact. Destroy their industrial base and remove Gedgen and his cronies. The man's already had his predecessor killed and made an attempt on the Hapen Queen Mother." Jason paused a beat, because timing was everything. "I have no doubt you will be next."
"You have intelligence to suggest that?"
Omos asked. Jason shook his head. "No, and I don't need it, or help from the Force to work it out. It's how Gedgen does business."
"If we launch that kind of assault on Corellia, it's something I should take to the Security Council. And even if they agree to it..."
"We're at war. You have all the legal powers to determine the conduct of the war with Admiral Niathal as you see fit."
"Until it costs more credits," said Omos. "And once we're conspicuously focused on Corellia, what are Bothui and Kamenor going to do?"
Omos had the perfect excuse now to admit to the meeting with Gedgen. He could have said that he was going to give peace talks one last try. He could have said anything to indicate that he was going to talk terms with a state that showed no signs of understanding the words common good, and whose quietly lethal leader could have scared a Hutt ganglord. And, Jason thought, any smart politician might have suspected that his intelligence service spied on him, just as they spied on all the other senators. A little game of words. Omos could have made the suggestion and watched Jason's reaction, brazening it out to test if his clandestine call had been picked up. But he didn't, and his future and his fate were sealed.
"So where are we going with this?"
Niathal asked.
"Same strategy? Keep dividing up the fleet until we have one ship per theater?"
"I think a full assault on Corellia is madness,"
said Omos.
"We might well have to consider it, but much later. In the meantime, my priority is to stop secessions from the Alliance from reaching the tipping point."
Jason placed his hands squarely on the arms of the Apakia wood chair and eased himself to his feet. "For the record, I think this is a big mistake, sir," he said. "And I would be happier if GAG could support our intelligence community in their efforts beyond Coruscant."
"I note your views, Colonel Solo, and I'm grateful for your strategic input so far."
Jason didn't catch Niathal's eye. He walked out, followed closely by her, and said nothing until they were back in her office. Well?
Not good,
she said. If he does a deal with Gedgen, we're not just back to square one. The Alliance is in a worse position than when it started.
And we'll be out of the game.
That's academic, because the game will be recurring wars.
Or Omos might end up with a vibroblade in his throat.
He's insane to meet Gedgen face to face without close protection anyway. He hasn't asked for it from us. He hasn't asked CSF either.
GA Intel?
No. We tap their comms, too.
You're a source of constant revelation, Jason Solo.
Are you in?
Say it.
Jason looked around the room, trying to look as if he was simply thinking, but suspicious that someone else might be doing to him what he did to them. Electronic eavesdropping. Was Niathal setting him up? No. He was sure he could sense bugs in a room. There were none. You know what I'm proposing.
I don't, actually. Not in detail. Say it.
Regime change. We remove him from office long enough to get this war won, and then hand it back to Senator Gasil when the situation is stable so that new elections can take place. Niathal made a little sputter that could have been laughter.
I get the removal. It's the gap in the middle between remove and elections that fascinates me.
We run the GA during the interim as a duumvirate. No dictatorship, joint control. Niathal indicated her uniform, and then reached out to jab a bony finger into the rank tab on his shoulder.
Military coup, that's what it's called. Let's not prevaricate.
Okay, I remove him and you take over alone.
I don't think so. Duumvirate sounds best to me.
I'll take care of Gedgen, by the way. He said. He's a massively destabilizing influence, and removing him will throw Corellia into disarray.
How will you take care of Omos?
I'll remove him by house arrest. I'll have someone there when Omos meets Gedgen. Jason checked his datapad. He needs only a day to do his business with Gedgen, no more. So my people have him under surveillance, ready to move. Then we have evidence to present to Gasil.
And then you arrest him.
I was thinking I might arrest him at the same time you present the evidence to Gasil. When we move, we have to move fast. No room to be outmaneuvered. Niathal let out a long breath. Jason waited.
I'll be ready to move on your signal. Make sure you keep me up to speed with all this, won't you?
It was done. Jason's takeover was in place. He had the GAG at his back, and Niathal would deliver the fleet as well as the army. With the right presentation of Omos selling out to the Corellians, it would be a very orderly coup. There was no need for unnecessary bloodshed. That was what this was all about. An end to violence, chaos, and instability. That was worth everything he was risking.
Safe House, Coruscant.
So you're going to do it before you achieve your full Sith powers, said Lumaya.
She lit the candles and closed the blinds. Jason needed to shut out the world and feel what was happening. He was running increasingly on a mundane agenda, the agenda of the lesser beings he worked with.
Why?
If I do it afterward, when might afterward be? Jason watched the flame shimmering and settled down cross-legged on the floor cushion. Omos is doing a deal with Gedgen. The deal excludes me, and Niathal, possibly in a rather terminal way.
Niathal is afraid of you, Jason, or at least wary.
Don't you think I know that? She'd be an idiot if she trusted anyone at this level of government.
You waste too much energy playing mundane games instead of using the Force.
I'll use it when I need to. Most of the time now, it's overkill.
Meditate, said Lumaya.
Jason stared through her for a moment, and then stared unblinking at the candle until he eventually closed his eyes. He opened one eye slowly, looking as if he might be about to make a joke. Lumaya didn't feel in a humorous mood. Actually, I called you for a reason, he said.
I know, but I'd like to approach this like force users, not like some tedious little committee in the Senate.
It was time to remind him he still had one more step to take before he could begin to teach her anything.
Calm yourself and put the world to one side.
Jason shut his eyes again, and for once, seemed to relax enough to allow a little of his state of mind to filter through the barrier that he now kept in place most of the time.
You don't need to play their games, Jason,
she said softly.
Even now, your powers put you far beyond their reach. Omas can't touch you, neither can Gedgen. When you achieve your destiny, they'll be less than irrelevant.
Powers or not, I can't control the galaxy on my own. I need to persuade, to carry people with me. The Force can't affect the minds of millions.
Jason, she said, I want you to take stock and feel. Stop overanalyzing. It won't reveal any truths to you. Just facts. Facts only show you what you want to see.
Jason opened his eyes again.
But it's so fleeting.
The line between a crazy impulse and guidance from the Force is getting harder to draw.
Because you think about it too much.
The impenetrable wall went up again. Lumaya felt it as he lapsed into silence. It's Ben, he said at last. It has to be Ben. Now she understood.
You're fond of the boy. Perhaps he's the child you don't have. This will be hard. And that's probably why it has to be him.
That's probably it, Jason said, and looked down at his clasped hands. And it's hard to kill someone who doesn't deserve it.
But you don't know how it will happen.
Exactly.
You can't see yourself taking a lightsaber to a 14-year-old boy.
Maybe it won't be so literal. I'm sending him to assassinate Durgedjian when he meets Omas to do his deal. It's a job that needs doing. It tests Ben's skills and commitment. It's far easier for a teenage boy to get past Gedgen's security, and perhaps it will put him in real mortal danger. Jason reached out to the low table nearby, leaning on one hand to stretch and pick up one of the candles in its transparent blue holder. Now is that a consequence of the task? Or is that why I'm sending him?
Am I sending him to his death? Let it play out, Lumaya said. Stop rationalizing and let it happen.
She stood up to take the candle from him. I need your help, he said. I need you to distract Mara for a while.
I'll let her find me. That should do the trick. Can you give me a possession of Ben's? Something that would prove to Mara that I could get at him easily without being traceable to you.
I'll get you a pair of his boots. He keeps several pairs in his locker. And Mara already suspects a GAG connection.
Surveillance Center, GAG Headquarters, Coruscant.
Captain Gearden loomed in the doorway, backlit by the light from the corridor.
Showtime,
he said.
Nyathal's just been designated as acting chief of state as of midnight.
The troopers on duty in the listening post looked up. Ben detached the bead amplifier in his ear and tried to make sense of that news.
What's happened to Omas?
He's going to be out of the office for a day.
Oh, I thought...
He has to give a little notice to hand over the reins of state to Nyathal when he's out of contact. You know, command codes, that kind of stuff. So we have a window for his trip to Volptr tomorrow.
What cover story has he given?
Ben asked.
Private medical matter.
Yeah, saving his backside, said Zverk.
I think this is the opportunity you've been waiting for, Ben.
Gearden beckoned to him.
Come on, briefing room.
He turned to Zverk.
I want to know his itinerary to Volptr. He won't be taking us along. But he'll still need transport, a minder and a pilot. So let's keep an eye on the logistics.
Bet he takes an intel zombie or two with him for company.
Well, we're keeping an eye on them, too. So that'll help us triangulate, won't it? Get to it, trooper.
The captain strode off down the corridor, whistling. When they reached the briefing room, Shivu and Lakoff were already there, poring over a wall full of illuminated holodisplays. Lakoff, looking far from comfortable in his brand new lieutenant's rank insignia, gave Ben a nervous grin.
Our source and coronet confirms that Gedgen's rescheduled all his engagements for tomorrow, said Shivu. It's on for sure.
Timetable?
No outbound timings, but he expects to be back in time for a meeting by 0800 the next day. They're just working out how we get you close enough to Gedgen, and that has to be after he's finished his meeting with Omos, because the boss wants the evidence of the meeting for the Security Council.
Revelation dawned. Ben had hoped he'd have had more preparation time, but this was it.
We're doing the hit at the same time as the meeting? Not when he's on the way back, or...
We might not get another chance to take a crack at Gedgen away from his home turf.
Lakoff beckoned to Ben and made him look inside a fabric holdall leaning against the wall.
Like it?
Ben couldn't work out what it was at first, but when he looked in the bag, it turned out to be a rifle with a folding stock. He unfolded it and snapped the stock into place, staring at it in numb realization.
It's a modified Carpaki 50,
Lakoff said, totally misreading Ben's reaction to the weapon.
Can't leave lightsaber marks all over Gedgen, can we? Bit of a giveaway. You're now going to make a very fast acquaint of a ballistic sniper rifle. You know, projectiles.
If you're trying to get me close to Gedgen, why do I need a sniper weapon?
In case we can't. Come on, let's get in a few hours on the indoor range.
Bevin Vasur Farm, 10 kilometers outside Kildabe, Mandalore.
Goran Bevin looked up from the trench, a pitchfork in one hand and a muddy grin on his face. It was beginning to rain, and he was up to his ankles in animal dung, but it seemed to make him perfectly happy.
And they said being active Mandalore wouldn't go to my head, he said, rubbing his nose on his sleeve. So you came home fast, then?
Fett kept his distance.
Found what I was looking for. You didn't expect me back?
I did. Some of the clan chieftains didn't. You have a habit of wandering off for a few years at a time.
Bevin heaved himself out of the trench and wiped his palms on the seat of his pants. He looked very, very pleased with himself.
If you'd been away any longer, I'd have called you. But since you're back... Want to see something amazing?
Fett wondered if now was a good time to tell Bevin the truth about his illness. The man had to know sooner or later.
Okay, amaze me.
Bevin beckoned and trudged through the mud toward the farm buildings.
Myrta behaving herself?
Bevin didn't look back over his shoulder.
Well, at least she hasn't tried to kill you again. That's a good sign. Kids can be such a handful.
Fett felt the mud suck at his boots.
She's a useful pair of fists in a fight.
She'll produce wonderfully ferocious great-grandchildren for you, Bobica.
Bevin paused a few beats. Fett tried to take in the phrase, great-grandchildren, and it left him stranded.
So whatever it was you went to do ended in a fight, did it?
Just had to ask questions emphatically.
You gotta tell me about it?
It seemed as good a time as any, and Fett didn't see the point of sugarcoating it.
I'm terminally ill. 2 years, tops. 8-9 months if I carry on like this.
Bevin still didn't turn around. He walked on for a few more meters, and then stopped in his tracks, and finally faced Fett. He looked genuinely upset. Fett couldn't recall anyone being upset for him before, except his father. Lack of caring worked both ways.
You're not gonna sit back and let it happen, are you, Bobica? We can do something, surely.
I found a clone who survived.
So they did get a little more out of Kosai than revenge and a few souvenirs, then.
There was no research data, just the clone, Jang Skirata. He wouldn't give me a blood sample, but he says he's got good medical resources. I'll explain later.
Bevin turned around and started walking again in silence. F- Fett would normally have found a family meal and a long explanation of the finer points of metallurgy worse than a spell in the Sarlacc. It was hard enough getting used to having a granddaughter without being besieged by Baveen's noisy, messy, demonstrative family. But that evening, he tolerated it.
"It's not just the ore,"
Medrit said, drawing an imaginary graph in midair with a Nuna drumstick.
"It's the processing. Part of the strength of the metal is in what's added during smelting and how it's worked. What you saw was just a test bench."
"Have we got the facilities to do that anymore?"
Fett wasn't used to eating in front of anyone else. Dinua's son and daughter, Shalk and Brilla, 7 and 5, he estimated, stared at him, unimpressed, across the table. The scrutiny of small children was unnerving.
"Do we have a windfall we can't exploit?"
"On a small scale, we can do it," Baveen said. "I've done a few rough calculations. If the load produces the yield we think it will, we're going to need some help, from mining right through to processing. Mandal Motors could process some of it, if they're willing to shift resources from combat craft. But the rest, we need droids."
"But what are you going to do with it?" Dinua asked.
"What?
Sell it for foreign currency? Or use it to arm yourselves?"
Dinua, orphaned on the battlefield like Fett, was a savagely smart woman. Baveen had adopted her the moment her mother was killed. But Fett found that ability, to turn strangers into family, that central part of Mandalorian culture, was beyond him. Even Medrit, impatient, critical, short-tempered, had accepted the unexpected addition to their household without a murmur. Adoption was what Mandalorians did. And always had.
"If he can do it, why can't I? With my own flesh and blood, too."
"We do both,"
Fett tried to stay on the subject.
"Some manufactured goods for export, some for our own rearmament."
"You'll find a lot of support for that," Baveen said. "Satisfies both camps."
"What else can I do with the time I have left to me, except leave Mandalore in decent shape?"
"If we've got it, someone will want to take it."
"You think anyone's stupid enough to try invading like the Empire did?"
Baveen said.
"After we kicked Vong's shibs like that?"
"Boba Weir's cussing,"
said Shulk gravely.
"Can I say shibs too?" "No, you can't."
Dinua clicked her teeth in annoyance.
"Buir, please, not in front of the kids. Mandalore, how are you going to announce the find? Other than the old-fashioned Mondo way, by showing up at the border with an invading army."
"Do we have to announce it?"
"If we want foreign revenue."
"We don't have a finance minister, but the job's yours."
"I'm serious."
"Commission a few starfighters and see who notices. Maybe this Mondo nationalist guy, Kadika, has a point. That we don't have to be on one side or the other. There's a third side, as Goran says."
It was only courtesy to address him by his first name in his own house. Fett had so little non-hostile interaction with anyone that basic etiquette felt like a minefield.
"Our own."
"I can make sure the Orotise notice," said Baveen. "But maybe a surprise is better."
"What kind of surprise?"
"The kind that makes you look up and run for a bomb shelter," Baveen said. "With a Mondal Motors logo on the fuselage."
"We've got no territorial ambitions beyond the sector. We've got at least a dozen planets here to worry about."
"I know. But take a planet in post-war recovery, an ongoing civil war, and a new find of Beskar. And we might have visitors. If not armed, then at least trying to do deals."
"Whatever. I don't lose sleep over what?"
Baveen filled the gap.
"Aruatise.
Aruatise think of us. I'll talk to Yumaget in the morning. See what Mandal Motors can commit."
GAG Headquarter Locker Rooms, Coruscant, 2100 hours.
Shivu took a long look at Ben and handed him a small container. It was filled with a dark brown fluid.
"You look deadbeat," said Shivu. "But before you turn in for the night, there's a few loose ends to tie up."
Ben, slumped on a bench with his back resting on his locker door, was ready to drop. He had to be up at 0300 to prep for the flight to Vulptor, and he still didn't know his final destination or the location for the hit. That wasn't unusual, apparently. It was just as well. He was used to improvising.
"I'm scoring 97%, sir."
Shivu sounded as if he'd stifled a laugh. He exuded a sense of pity. "It's hard to know what to say."
"I'm ready. Really, I am."
"I meant that it's amazing that we can pretty well train a sniper in a day. If he's a Jedi, of course." Shivu put the bottle in Ben's hand. "You're being inserted ahead of time with Lakoff, and I'll be shadowing Omas's flight. We'll RV on Vulptor at Charby City Spaceport, because he's meeting Gedgen in one of the conference rooms there that they hire out for business meetings by the hour. Personally, I think GA Intel is insane to let him do that. No sterile area, no screening, no security except for the two guys with him for close protection. But it's anonymous. There's no advance booking to trace. Charby is a slum, and we can stroll in." Ben held the bottle up to the light.
"So, what's this?"
"Hair dye. Most species tend to recall red-headed humans a bit too well. You're still a genetic minority. And Omas knows you well enough to look twice if he spots you."
"Tell me I don't have to wear makeup to cover my freckles."
Ben's mind was a couple hours ahead, thinking of a few hours' sleep he could get on the flight. He could study the layout of the spaceport on his datapad. It was all going to go fine, he told himself.
"So, the second vessel's for backup in case he diverts?"
"Partly. And partly so we have something incriminating to abandon on Vulptor. Read the label, dye your hair, and report to the landing strip at 2230. I'll see you there." Shivu started to walk away. Ben jumped to his feet.
"Sir, what's going to be incriminating?"
The captain looked at Ben with that mix of sadness and patience that Ben had seen on his dad's face too often.
"I think anyone would believe Corellians had neutralized Gedgen, given the right vessel abandoned at the port. You know, Corellian registered, Corellian trace for forensics. You can do a Corellian accent, can't you? If push comes to shove, and you need to speak, that is. There have to be plenty of Corellians with a grudge against him, knowing their politics."
Ben thought of Uncle Han's accent, or what was left of it. He sounded more Coruscant-y these days.
"Can do. But how do we know we won't fall over real Corellians trying to stop Gedgen doing a deal with the enemy?"
"That," said Shivu, "would be unbelievably hilarious for all the wrong reasons. Assuming he has a deal to put on the table anyway."
"I'm going to kill someone. And in 24 hours, I'll be back here as if nothing's happened. Any reason why I can't take my vibroblade?"
Ben fished it from his pocket and held it out to Shivu.
"My mom gave it to me and, well, you know."
"You can take whatever works for you, as long as you don't leave or carry evidence that links the hit to us."
Shivu examined the blade.
"Yeah, I understand."
He pulled down the neck of his shirt a little to reveal a gold chain.
"No ID, of course, but my girlfriend gave it to me, and I never go on patrol without it."
It helped to know everyone got edgy before a mission and needed a little reminder of their loved ones. Shivu got halfway to the doors before he turned around and seemed to be working up to saying something.
"I realize your father might find it hard to accept what you do, Ben, but I'm proud of you," he said. "Still, if I had a son, I wouldn't be letting him do this kind of thing until he was an adult. It's not as if we haven't got enough trained men to do it. But, well, Colonel Solo has his reasons, I'm sure."
Ben sat thinking over that statement for a while, and realized that Shivu had said father, not parents. Maybe he thought that his mother would understand a job like this. Ben stood in the refresher with the dye worked into lather on his head, and caught sight of himself in a mirror. He felt ridiculous. The foam looked mauve, and he wondered if something had gone horribly wrong. When he rinsed it off, though, his hair was brown, just brown, and he was looking at a stranger. Good. He needed to be someone else, for all kinds of reasons.
The Skywalker's apartment, Coruscant.
Luke woke in a heart-pounding panic and reached out toward a hooded shape at the foot of the bed, knowing he was dreaming but unable to stop himself from reacting to the specter that dissolved as he became fully awake. He hadn't had the dream of the menacing figure in the hooded cloak for a while. Now it was back. It was 4 a.m, and Mara still hadn't come home. Luke reached for his lightsaber, which he'd been keeping on the nightstand lately, and made a cautious inspection of all the rooms. He couldn't sense flesh and blood anywhere, but he could detect something. The presence was so close now that he could almost feel breath on the back of his neck. And then he sensed amusement. The presence, now at the door to the apartment, he was sure, was like a cloud of billowing smoke in his mind. Lumaya. Lumaya! Luke rushed to the front doors, at the same time concentrating hard on using the force to jam the two sets of doors in the corridor outside that stood between the apartment and the lifts. The doors parted with a gasp of air, and Luke sprang into the corridor with his lightsaber raised. One set of doors was wedged open with something, trying repeatedly to close and making little mechanical groans each time the inner edges hit the obstruction and bounced back a few centimeters. There was no sign of Lumaya, but she'd been here seconds before. Luke could almost taste her on the air. Frustrated and furious, he strode down the corridor to see what had jammed the doors apart. It was a pair of black boots. Army boots, with segmented Durasteel plates around the ankle. The kind that Ben wore. He parted the doors with a force push and squatted to recover the boots. They were Ben's. He went back into the apartment to grab his jacket, opening his comlink to Jason as he went. He didn't care what time it was. Jason answered immediately. It seemed he didn't sleep much either. "Where's Ben?" Luke demanded.
"Asleep, Luke."
Jason had that calm, mock-soothing tone that did anything but soothe him. Patronizing little jerk.
"Is there a problem?"
"Have you had any intruders at GAGHQ tonight?" Jason gave a quiet little laugh.
"We're the ones who do forced entry, Luke."
"Someone's left Ben's boots here as a calling card."
"I don't understand. Did he leave them behind?"
"He doesn't keep any of his uniform at our place. It's Lumaya. She's taunting me, showing me she can get at Ben anytime she pleases." Jason was silent. Luke waited.
"I can't give you an explanation for that. I really can't,"
Jason said eventually. "Well, Lumaya's jerking my chain, as she probably was at Galater, too." "Stupid, stupid, stupid. How could I ever have been fooled like that?" "And she has someone inside your organization, so I suggest you get that sorted out fast."
"We've had one investigation already and found nothing. We'll have another if that makes you happier."
Jason's voice sounded both offended and irritated, but Luke couldn't even take that at face value any longer.
"But I can assure you Ben is safe. He's even got pretty good protection right next to him. Lieutenant Lakoff."
"Nice to see that guy get promoted. He strikes me as being very loyal to you."
"As his grandfather was to Vader, Luke. You can't buy loyalty like that. Ben's in good hands. Let's talk again in the morning."
Luke shut the link dead. No, the morning wouldn't do. And there was no point talking to Jason, who was clearly trussed and tied as far as Lumaya's influence was concerned. She was right under his nose. So much for what he'd learned in his 5-year sabbatical from his arcane force techniques. Luke jogged to the landing pad and tore off in the speeder, maybe a little faster than was safe. He opened the comlink. "Mara, we have a problem. Lumaya."
"I'm with Jaina, sweetheart. Do you want me to..."
"She's been outside our apartment. Stay where you are. I'll be there in a few minutes."
"When there's a trail going cold?"
"Or a diversion."
"Or a trail she wants you to think is a diversion."
Yes. Mara and Lumaya both had that layer upon layer way of thinking, just as Palpatine had taught them. "I know what she wants," he said, and shut the link.
GA Starfighter Command, Coruscant.
"You know, this always works on the crime holovids."
Mara added another illuminated marker to the holochart of the galaxy and stepped back to see if a pattern of Lumaya's movements emerged. It was a big galaxy, and Lumaya seemed to cover a lot of space, which now included Mara's own front doors.
"Might as well use the time productively."
Jaina leaned over the desk and tapped in more coordinates. Now that she was a civilian again, she was here in her capacity as a Jedi, working for Luke Skywalker and the Council. But she slipped back into fleet ways fast.
"So let's add in Alima's known whereabouts."
"Well, there's no pattern there either."
"Do you think it's a case of Alima stalking Lumaya?"
looking for scraps from her table? Why do those two seem to hang out together? They both need a lot of spare parts? Mara stifled a laugh. That's not nice, Jaina. Seriously, they haven't got enough functioning parts to make one decent humanoid between them. They're both good at hiding, whether by disguising their presence or erasing the memory of being seen. Mara was feeling around her in the Force, just waiting for Lumaya to spring from nowhere. She could sense her, but not near. Lumaya's broken her cover, and she's not stupid, so she wants to be seen. Jaina kept checking the chrono on the wall, and then looking at her own timepiece.
Did you see Jason?
Yes.
And?
You want the truth, Jaina?
Don't I always?
Lumaya's bending him somehow. Okay, no need to tell me I was the last person to notice that.
I wasn't going to. Did you mention that?
Yes. I thought it was time someone dropped a hint that we noticed our Jason had turned into a monster. Mara was getting angry, and her honest inner voice told her that the only person who deserved that anger was herself, for defending Jason while the fact that things were going disastrously wrong was staring her in the face. But Mara was human and scared for Ben, and it boiled over into Jaina. Forgive me for asking, but being his twin, have you never had this out with him?
I tried. He responded with a court-martial charge, remember?
I can't help thinking that you might have tried slugging him.
Suddenly he's my responsibility? I'm the one who said he was going dark way back.
Okay, I'm sorry. Mara put her hands up in mock submission. Change of plan, said Luke, stepping out of the turbo lift with his hair disheveled and a bag in one hand. I'm going after Lumaya. Enough.
No, you're not, Mara said. You're too close to this. She's baiting you.
Luke dumped the bag on the desk, disrupting the holochart. Jaina stepped back.
Ben's boots, said Luke.
And the point is?
Deposited at our apartment by Lumaya.
Mara put her hand on the boots and felt the remnants of dark energy. Now she was mad. Cold, clear, icy mad.
She's been into GAG headquarters, or Jason's apartment. I don't know which idea I like less.
I need to settle this with her.
It is, as some admiral once said, a trap.
For her, biting off more than she can chew.
Jaina looked at them both, still feeling a little wounded.
Uncle Luke, I'll stick my nose in here and say it's better if we go after Lumaya now, because she's clearly playing a game, and I've never seen you angry like this before.
Luke, the question to ask yourself is this, Mara said, pulling on her jacket and checking her personal weapons. What will you do when you catch her?
Luke swallowed hard.
I know what I have to do.
And what was that conversation we had the other day about being fit for role? Me, trained killer. You, honest guardian of right? Lightsaber, vibroblades, holdout blaster, flechette launcher, and the last of my transponders. Check. Here's the plan. You keep an eye on Jason while I go after her.
I'm coming too, Jaina said. I'd hate to miss Alima if she shows up.
Mara tapped her forefinger to her brow in a mock salute and walked off with Jaina. When she got in the turbo lift, she checked her datapad to see where Ben's transponder had gotten to.
If you've left that blade in your locker, Ben.
A little earlier, it had shown up on the datapad's small screen as a static blip in Galactic City, in GAG headquarters. Now it didn't. Mara never panicked, but she reserved the right to professional apprehension. She switched the scale of the chart.
What's wrong?
Jaina asked.
Nothing at all.
Mara flicked through ever larger scales of the screen until she picked up the transponder blip again, and the coordinates didn't make sense. Ben appeared to be on Vulptor.
What takes you there, Ben? Vulptor's not in the war.
Mandal Motors Research Wing, Keldabe, Mandalore.
What do you think then, Fett?
Jeer Yamaget was the kind of man who probably had to be anesthetized to get him into a business suit. He stood with his arms folded, gazing rapt at an airframe that Fett hadn't seen before. An incongruously scruffy and disturbingly young man in dark green coveralls and partial armor.
Prototype?
Yamaget nodded.
Started life as a Kirgalar. Up to 3 crew, or 2 with extra payload. Atmosphere capable, configurable for anything from planet pounding to hunter-killer roles. And fast. Now tell me it's not gorgeous.
Research wing was a flattering term for the collection of scruffy sheds and hangars. But the ramshackle appearance of the exterior belied the technology within. Mondal Motors had struggled to get back on its feet under a galactic alliance that wasn't handing out reconstruction grants to Mondalore. Now it had an edge it could exploit.
How fast?
Asked Fett. Yamaget probably didn't look at his wife and kids with as much adoration as he was lavishing on the assault fighter.
0.4 hyperdrive, the ultimate shock weapon.
And you never offered me the chance to purchase?
Fett had modified Slave 1 to a 0.7.
That beats an X-Wing.
Unfinished prototype.
It was about 15 meters nose to tail, with an 8-meter span, a faceted charcoal gray wedge of a ship that had none of the insectoid lines of the Star Viper. Fett walked around it, noting empty racks and housings, and took a guess that it would pack 4 laser cannons and maybe a couple of other weapons. The tail ended in a flat section with grills and vents that looked like the ports on a datapad. The skin was totally plain, in angled surfaces unbroken except for the Mythosaur logo, picked out in a lighter gray on the side hatches.
So it's fast and pretty.
Deflective stealth hull, cooled vents, scanner absorbent coating.
Yamaget flourished a forearm plate attachment, tapped it, and the canopy popped. It parted into 2 top-hinged hatches, and he swung himself into the cockpit.
Also hinges from the lower edge, in case the pilot has to bang out. Now, the avionics. Synthetic vision, panoramic cockpit display, eye-controlled switch selection, aiming the works.
Sounds like you had a contest to see how many gizmos you could cram into one fighter.
All we've been able to do since the Vong War ended is re-establish our basic production models and work up some better ideas.
Yamaget leaned over the side of the fighter.
They all ended up in here.
So?
Well, you wanted to know what we might manufacture with the new Beskar. Personally, I'd be inclined to incorporate it into the airframe. Micronized Beskar skin, or laminate Beskar armor.
That would make it the fastest, least vulnerable fighter on the market. The weapons load might be a compromise.
Fett wasn't sure if he had the power or right to tell Mandal Motors what to do with their product. This wasn't Coruscant, where national security overrode commercial concerns by law.
Add the top-end armaments, though, and I wouldn't want that sold to anyone else.
Don't worry. We'll de-enrich the spec for export. We live here, remember? We all lost family to the Vong.
Yamaget jumped down from the cockpit with an agility Fett envied. Then he pressed the forearm plate attachment, and the fighter made a faint grinding sound before tilting back on its tail section and lifting through a full 90 degrees to sit upright, a mechanism not dissimilar to Slave 1's.
It can land vertically in a footprint of a little over 32 square meters.
Fett walked a few meters away to get a better idea of the shape. It didn't look like any other vessel he'd seen.
I bet it does tricks, too.
Our shares have rocketed, and we haven't even unveiled this.
I bought a few. Someone had to make sure the majority shareholding stayed in Mandalorian hands.
Just as well we don't have a law against insider dealing.
I don't intend to sell. Might sign them over to someone, on the condition they never sell on to Arutise.
Is that a go-ahead for production?
Full spec for us, de-enriched for them.
Fett walked away briskly, feeling his unconnected acts of prudence falling together in a policy of sorts.
Make sure the export hyperdrive spec is a fraction better than an X-Wing. No more.
Yamaget trailed after him.
We're going to arm the Confederacy then,
said Yamaget.
We'll arm anybody, including the GA, if they can pay.
Fett hadn't even thought about the next move. It just happened.
Provided Colonel Jason Solo comes here in person to negotiate the deal.
You're a subtle man, Fett.
I've never been called that before.
50% of production for our own defense?
Defense. That was one word for it. Agreed.
Mandalorians liked a sensible compromise. The best deals were where both sides were happy, or where one was happy and the other dead.
"It'll be called the Basilisk," Yamaget called after him. "The Basilisk. I always had a soft spot for the ancient battle droids."
Chabi Spaceport, Vulptor, Deep Core.
Ben pressed as close to the viewport as he could to peer at the permacrete below. It was hazy daylight outside, but his body said it was still last night and he needed more sleep. As far as the rest of the spaceport was concerned, the well-maintained but very old Income Tourer was not a Galactic Alliance Guard ship carefully contaminated with Corellian dust, Corellian food waste, Corellian fabric, and any number of other touches designed to show a forensics team that the vessel definitely came from Corellia. And the battered intersystem delivery cutter tailing Cal Omas's shuttle wasn't a spy vessel with top-of-the-line comms, spoofing devices, and an overpowered hyperdrive. Jory Lakoff wasn't a GAG assassin either. He was just a nice, ordinary young Corellian on an adventure with his younger cousin in an elderly ship he'd saved every spare credit for a couple of years to buy. The trouble was that Ben could believe that all too easily, even though he'd seen the range of weapons Lakoff carried under his jacket. It was a long wait. Shivu would make contact with them when he landed. His last transmission said he was a few minutes behind Omas's shuttle, which wouldn't attract suspicion. They said Vulptor had once been a lovely planet. It didn't look lovely now. The skies had that polluted, smoky haze that meant there were wonderful red sunsets here and not much else to be grateful for. And this was after they tried to clean up the environment. The vast landing strip, landing field, more like, was scattered with dozens upon dozens of craft in varying stages of disrepair, some taking on board supplies and fuel, some berthing next to freight warehouses where conveyor belts disgorge crates into their holds. Their outline shimmered in the heat haze from idling drives. And there were all kinds of species wandering around on foot between the vessels, stretching their legs, anywhere between one pair and four of them, it seemed.
"Stand by," Lakoff said quietly, pressing his fingertip to his ear. "It's the captain."
"Yes, sir.
Copy that."
He looked up.
"About 12 minutes before Omas lands. Shiva's right behind him in the landing queue."
Ben perked up. The Karpaki was folded in two inside his jacket, right on the limit of what he could hide, and the vibroblade was tucked in his hip pocket. Ben fidgeted with the vibroblade, wondering how his mother would have tackled a job like this. Ben switched seats in the cramped interior to look out from the starboard side. Gedgen's ship should have landed by now, according to its flight plan. One pilot, three passengers, maximum 5-hour stopover. That was what it said on the CPA information database that his datapad, scrubbed of all identity in case of capture, showed him. Ben concentrated on centering himself, edging a little toward that state where he vanished from the Force. He pulled himself back just as he felt a drifting sensation that could have been disappearance, or nodding off.
"Plug yourself in," Lakoff whispered. "It's a go."
Ben activated his comlink and earpiece and shut down the environmental controls to leave the Tourer. When Lakoff opened the hatch, the air and noise hit Ben like a solid wall. It smelled of factories and sulfur. They ambled down the ramp, working hard at looking ordinary, and made their way toward the terminal buildings as if they were killing time, not politicians. Lakoff scratched his ear, repositioning the earpiece.
"Got you, sir. Position?"
Ben picked up Shivu's voice clearly.
"He'll pass 30 meters to the left of you, unless he deviates. Heading for Building G. You pick him up, and I'll follow you in."
"No visual on the target yet."
They couldn't afford to be spotted. Ben slouched and meandered as 14-year-old boys were prone to do, turning around from time to time to chat to Lakoff about safe and meaningless trivia. Baker Rock, speeders, anything, while he took a cautious look across the permacrete in Omas's direction. And there he was, flanked by two men in working clothes, a carefully scruffy figure himself.
"Going okay?"
Lakoff whispered, not looking toward the three men. One of the GA intelligence agents walked through the doors of Building G in front of Omos. The other followed close enough to tread on his heels. They almost vanished in the crowds inside the terminal building, but Ben kept them in sight even though he lost LeCoff for a few moments. One of them appeared to be checking the numbers on various doors and exits as he walked, and eventually he stopped at one marked 53L and inserted a credit chip in the slot to one side. The doors parted, and Ben got a glimpse of a small, brightly lit room almost filled by a white Duraplast table ringed by chairs. There was already someone in there. The doors closed again.
"You can do this,"
LeCoff said.
"How many in there? I can't place the strip cam under the doors if someone else is going to come along and open them again."
Ben closed his eyes and concentrated on the ebb and flow of the Force, the patterns of density that he could both feel at the roof of his mouth and see as speckled color behind his eyelids.
"Six," he said. "They're all inside now."
"Can you see lottery numbers, too?"
LeCoff made his way casually through the shoals of people and squatted down to adjust his boot. Ben saw him take out what looked like a small, flimsy strip, then slide the thing under the hairline gap with quick ease. Strip cams were very small these days, the size of a coat check stub. They really were flimsy, and just as disposable once they'd finished transmitting.
"Lovely,"
said Shivu's voice in Ben's ear.
"I can see right up Gedgen's nose. Good clear sound. Nice job, Jory."
Eventually, Ben glanced around and spotted Shivu leaning against a drinks dispenser on the other side of the concourse. He was recording the output from the strip cam and transmitting it back to GAG headquarters. As soon as he had confirmation that it had been received and stored, he'd erase his datapad and send a code to the strip cam to shred its data. It'd be just a scrap of garbage the cleaners would sweep up, if they ever came this way. It looked as if they didn't. Ben and LeCoff could hear the conversation in their earpieces, both of them monitoring it so they knew when to vanish, wait for Gedgen to emerge, and follow him. It was a fascinating conversation. He recognized Omos's voice. Gedgen sounded softer than he did on the HNE bulletins. Ben was hearing the last words Der Gedgen would ever speak.
"So, we can agree as gentle beings to cease hostilities while we sort out a compromise?"
"Before or after I take this to the Senate?"
Omos asked.
"I'm not referring this to my assembly, yet. You might not need to refer it to yours,"
Gedgen replied.
"We'll stand down if you agree to that form of revised wording in the commitment of planetary defense assets to the GA.
You might be able to deliver that with Corellian forces, but can you pull back the Bothans?"
"Are you sure Nyathol will do as you tell her?"
"She's a career officer. She will. As a show of goodwill, you'll commit forces to helping us restore order in places like the CPAN system."
"Of course. And you need us to come back into the GA fold to stop the membership hemorrhaging away."
"I won't ask for any statement that causes loss of face. I know how proud Corellians are. Just something along the lines of differences being bridgeable."
"That's very gracious, Chief Omos.